allowed me to go up to the mountain. And I've looked over, and I've seen the promised land. I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land. So I'm happy tonight. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not fearing any man. Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord.
Dr. Martin Luther King speaking April 3rd, 1968. Within 24 hours, he would be dead. Assassinated on the balcony of the Lorraine Motel, April 4th, 1968. Today is the federal holiday that honors him. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Tammy Warrenoff, Libby Rainey, Sam Alkoff, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, Sharina Nadura, Tamari Astudio, Adriano Contreras, and Maria Terracena. Mike DeFilippo and Miguel Nogueira are our engineers. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Julie Crosby, Miriam Barnard, Hugh Grand, David Prude, Vesta Godarz, and Carl Marxer, and to our camera crew, John Randolph, Kieran Krug-Meadows, Anna Osbeck, and Matt Ely. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
This is KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. KBOO's Board of Directors meets on the fourth Monday of the month at 6 p.m. This month's meeting will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland and online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting virtually can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
If you think the art of conversation is dead, you probably haven't listened to Jonesy. Or maybe you have. In any case, Jonesy brings you conversations with some of the most interesting people in the world of books, podcasts, radio, theater, music, food, and humor, guaranteed to entertain and enlighten. I should know, I'm the host of Jonesy, Ken Jones. No relation, by the way. A tagline I've long since beaten into the ground. So tune into KBOO on air or online every second and fourth Thursday of the month at 10:30 a.m.
From Pacifica Radio in San Francisco, this is Flashpoints. I'm Dennis Bernstein. Today on the show, San Francisco City Attorney David Chu speaks out against Trump's decision to cut off federal aid to all sanctuary cities very soon. Also, Haiti Action co-founder Robert Roth talks about Haiti in the context of expanding U.S. aggression and the reinstallation or installment of the Monroe Doctrine for the hemisphere. Also, Richard Becker, co-founder of Answer Coalition, analyzes Trump's plans for exerting full U.S. control over the regional resources. Becker says Answer Coalition is mounting a full and robust people's response to Trump's imposition of authoritarian rule. All this and more coming up straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Well, Trump announced today, earlier today, that he was taking the action, he's tried this before, to cut off all federal aid to sanctuary cities. That includes San Francisco, and we're going to be talking to the situation with City Attorney David Cho. He has been in the middle of fighting against Trump's attempt to undermine the possibility of cities to become sanctuary cities. City Attorney, welcome to Flashpoints. It's good to have you with us. Could you outline the multiple things that might occur as a result of a cutoff if, in fact, Trump has his way? What are the multiple consequences?
Well, I should just cut to the chase. We have been in court over these issues before, both during the first Trump administration as well as this past year. And federal courts have repeatedly held that sanctuary policies are lawful. The federal government cannot commandeer local police officers to enforce their federal immigration laws. They cannot deputize our police officers as their ICE agents. The Trump administration has repeatedly tried to do this before, to withhold funding, to impose illegal funding conditions on cities like San Francisco. And we have taken repeated legal action to protect our federal funding and will continue to do so. But if they are successful in the courts, it would be catastrophic. We'd either be forced to choose between allowing police officers to act as ICE agents, which is unbelievably unacceptable for obvious reasons, or San Francisco could be forced to give up, just for our city alone, billions of dollars, close to $4 billion. This is a threat that the administration has made to hundreds of cities across our country. My city, along with Santa Clara, we are litigating a case representing 50 of our cities to defend our ability to ensure sanctuary policies, which are really about strengthening public safety, making sure that we're building trust between our local law enforcement and our diverse communities.
And again, and who exactly is going to be hurt most, and how will this boil down if you're not able to restrain Trump?
Well, at one level, clearly Trump has been targeting our immigrant communities. We're talking about our neighbors, families, you know, immigrants who've built businesses, homes here. But this is also a policy that will impact all of us, regardless of your immigration background, because we know that when people trust law enforcement, victims and witnesses come forth, arrests are made, all of us are safer. When community members feel comfortable reporting crimes, accessing healthcare, going to school, our communities are strengthened. And this is in part why sanctuary cities have safer crime rates than non-sanctuary jurisdictions. All the studies show that sanctuary jurisdictions are as safe, if not safer, than non-sanctuary jurisdictions. I'll just also point out that San Francisco is one of the safest cities in the country. And targeting our immigrant community means that you're going to scare folks off from being victims and witnesses, from being witnesses and testifying against crimes, working with police officers to actually solve crimes. We need to make sure that doesn't happen. We need to make sure that we have policies that are actually keeping us all safe.
And speaking of those policies, I imagine you're in the loop. What kinds of plans are there if, once again, the feds, ICE shows up in large numbers, if they attempt what's going on in Minneapolis, in your city? I imagine you all are planning and ready.
You know, we're going to do what we always do. We continue to inform our residents about their rights. We want to make sure that while the federal government has the right to enforce their federal immigration laws, and there's nothing that we're doing as cities to interfere with that, the flip side of that, we are not going to enable them. Our sanctuary policies do not allow local law enforcement to deputize themselves as ICE agents. Trump is trying to commandeer our local police officers as ICE agents, and that is not what that's not what is allowed in a city like San Francisco and in many jurisdictions around our country.
Beautiful. I want to thank you for taking the time out and being so patient with us. We're happy to have the information. Incredibly important story. We're going to see where it goes. Please stay safe.
Thank you.
Thanks for the time. You're welcome.
Of course. Thank you.
And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. After a major blackout of almost 20 minutes, we're back. Hopefully, we'll be able to keep going. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to be joined by Richard Becker of Answer. And also, Gloria LaRiva is going to talk to us about the situation in Cuba and what's going on there. And it's problematic. Stay with us. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Welcoming back to these airwaves, Mr. Richard Becker, co-founder of Answer Coalition, deeply engaged in the resistance to the expanding actions by the Trump administration to reimpose the Monroe Doctrine here in this region, this part of the world. Dick Becker, why don't you begin giving us a little bit of your analysis. You think deeply about these things. You've been watching policy in the region for a long time. Where are we now? What does it appear to you that Trump is doing, has been able to do? What are your concerns? How do you see this?
Well, it's interesting, I think, and important to look at where Trump's policies came from. And I know you've talked about this, Dennis, on your show many times, the Project 2025, which Trump stated that he knew nothing about when he was running. He didn't know anything. And what a surprise that some of the main authors of that then became in charge of the policies. And so we've seen what they've done with the FCC. We've seen what they've done. And that was Carr, Brendan Carr. And we've seen what Kennedy has done in the Health, Department of Health and Human Services, and what Russell Vought, the main author of this, is, you know, he's really a key figure in the government. And they've pushed through a number of really damaging policies and damaging initiatives, and they're trying to do more right now. So, for instance, you know, we can see that, I think that we can see also very clearly that the Trump agenda is the agenda of the super rich, the billionaires, on the one hand. It's based on them and their interests. And in order to achieve their interests, it is the Trump program is a program of white supremacy. And it has been right from the very beginning. The first speech, of course, that Trump gave when he entered political life with his announcement of his 2016 candidacy, it's been white supremacy. So we have we see great damage being done to programs that are addressing the very real racism, sexism, homophobia, anti-disabled people, that these policies, and these are the policies that Trump is using to play to a part of the population in order to get their support for what is really a program that it will really and is already harming so many people, including so many people who vote for Trump himself. And the other side, I think, of it, the international side of it, and this is, of course, very sketchy, but the international side of it is that Trump pretended to be some kind of anti-war figure, and he was you know, that Make America First thing he conveyed to people meant less wars. But now we see he's bombed Iran, he's bombed Iraq, he's bombed Nigeria, he's bombed Venezuela and kidnapped its leader. And of course, and above all, what we've seen in the last 2.5 years is Trump's all-out support for Israel and its genocidal war against the Palestinian people and against the people of Lebanon as well. So they're continuing. At the same time, we have to say the resistance has been very strong and continues to be very strong. And if you look at what's happening in Minneapolis, and I'm sure many of the listeners are following that very closely, you can see that none of this is going to go down without a fight. And we believe it's a fight that we have to win and that we are going to win.
And Richard, what does it say to you at this point that Trump is willing to double down? They're undermining any investigation of the murder of this 37-year-old activist, peace activist, award-winning poet with the dog in the back of her car. Where does this take it to a new level? You've been around a while, but this seems to be really an expansion of police power in a way we haven't seen in quite a while.
That is what is in the works, and this, and particularly on the national level, the ICE police, and you know, the ICE police have been immensely increased in number. The recruitment that's going on, the bonuses that are being offered to them, to come into what is really a brutal occupation force in the communities where it has been deployed, and this again is where we see the central battle taking place right now. The central battle is around the struggle against deportations, the brutality that has been brought down on communities all across the country. And you know what we're seeing also is, you know, both in terms of what your first guest, City Attorney David Chu, pointed out, was that this is illegal. All of this is illegal. All of this is a violation of law. So what we really see the Trump administration trying to do is to reshape the government, to reshape the way the government functions, and to reshape the and demean the rights of people, the benefits that serve so many people. Their aim is to change the form of the government to one which is really the Trump dictatorship. And that's why it's so important. And of course, it's not just Trump, the others with him who are benefiting from it, but it's what makes it so critical that we carry on the struggle. And coming up are a number of very important activities. There's on January 20th, which is next Tuesday, a week from today, there are going to be walkouts all across the country, called by the Women's March, but many other organizations, including ANSWER, are part of this. There'll be a demonstration, a rally that'll take place, and followed by a march at 4 o'clock at the Civic Center next Tuesday. And then on the 23rd, and this is, I think, very critical, it's something that might not be called a general strike, but sure looks like a general strike, a call for universities, workplaces, schools, for people to walk out on that day, to a day without an immigrant, that idea, but expanded a day without everybody, because there is this critical struggle that's going on that, again, the outcome has immense consequences for our future.
Speaking with Richard Becker, with the ANSWER Coalition, you've become a master of organizing in the public interest. You have been a part of key resistance movements for decades. Dick, how does it look now? Are people willing, do you suppose, to stand up? What's your sense of you've been out there. I saw you over the weekend. A lot of people showed up in downtown San Francisco. There were actions all over the country. How what does the activist movement look like now? Are you encouraged by what you see in the streets?
Very encouraged. Really very encouraged. And I think everyone should feel encouraged, and I think everyone should join the movement too, who is opposed to what's happening. No, just to give you an example, like Trump talks about this, about like he's a great defender of white people, and you know he wants, you know, just trying to make white people loyal to him. He gave that ridiculous thing about the white South Africans, the Afrikaners, being slaughtered. And they wrote a letter. Hundreds of them wrote a letter, said not one of us has been killed, and none of our property has been taken. But I would just mention that when the No Kings Day happened back in October, I happened to be in upstate New York. I went to deliberately to see, not in the main city, Rochester there, of that area, but in a town called Fairport, which has 5,500 people. And the demonstration in Fairport was 2,400 people, and it was 99% white people. So I think, you know, we're working to build a multinational, multiracial movement. But it's very important to see that so many white people across the country are also rejecting white supremacy, because when you fight Trump, you're really fighting against white supremacy. And I think that, and in addition to the mobilizations of all different communities, and that is what has been taking place, is very encouraging.
All right, let's also bring into the conversation Gloria LaRiva. Gloria has been engaged in terms of supporting, protecting, talking about the assaults, the U.S. destabilizations having to do with Cuba. And since the United States has been going after Venezuela, it has gotten a lot worse, very precarious situation there. Maybe you can set up the scene for us, Gloria. What's happening in Cuba these days post declaration of war against Venezuela by the U.S.? What's the implication?
Thank you, Dennis. Well, first, in these last days, ever since the U.S. attacked Venezuela and kidnapped President Maduro and Celia Flores, the people are in mourning in Cuba, just across the country, for the deaths of the combatants, the men who were defending Maduro in his residence, along with dozens of Venezuelan men and women who were all murdered, just brutally assassinated as they were defending the president. And so the flag's been flying at half-mast. People are very angry. It has really heightened the major resistance of the people. The Cuban people have a very long history, and they're reminding the world and the people today and the media and the messages of President Díaz-Canel, of the foreign minister, Bruno Rodriguez, and everybody with a voice there are saying, don't mess with us. Don't you dare mess with us. And the foreign minister accused the U.S. of fomenting a belligerent chaos and trying to overturn the sovereignty of countries, because we're talking not just about Venezuela, as Richard Becker said, but Colombia threatened just because Petro is speaking out, and anybody who stands in the way, Mexico included. And the thing about Cuba is it's highly prepared militarily, but we have to remember 47 square miles of Cuban territory in a huge deep water bay called Guantanamo is occupied by the U.S. ever since 1898. 47 square miles. And when you think about that being Cuban territory, it's a threat to them. It's like a dagger to their heart. And still, the U.S. knows. Even Trump mentioned, yeah, they're pretty strong people. But, of course, he's spouting off a lot of lies and myths about Cuba.
What could a total collapse mean? What could a total collapse mean?
Well, there was a memo, a clandestine memo of the U.S. government from April 6, 1960. Many people have heard about this now. Just recently revealed a few years ago by Lester Mallory, who was a State Department employee who wrote a recommendation based on a request from President Eisenhower what to do about Cuba. And he said in his assessment, he goes, well, the country has this country supports Fidel Castro, communism is growing quickly, and he said, you know, at least 50% of the people support him, and we have to act now and decisively. So he laid out a recipe saying we need to reduce the people's ability, the purchasing ability of the people, cause hardship, anger, dissatisfaction, suffering, economic suffering, in order for them to overthrow the government. The government is not in any danger of overthrow because the vast majority support the government. But more than that, they may be critical at some moments of things or unhappy about things, but they don't blame the Cuban government. They know what the blockade is about. Evermore, they're furious about what happened to Venezuela. They consider that a sister republic, hand in hand, all the way from the time that Hugo Chavez and Fidel Castro signed agreements. They have, that bond has not been broken, nor will it be. Cuba has 20,000 doctors providing health care to the free health care system that Venezuela has managed in return for the oil. And of course, people have heard when Trump said the other day there will be no money and no oil coming into Cuba at all. And they think by that that they can force them. But the U.S. doesn't know the Cuban people, like the U.S. didn't know the Vietnamese people or the Palestinian people or others in the world who have resisted despite enormous suffering. And the people are suffering, you know?
Yeah, a lot of suffering, and there could be a lot more coming down the line. If people are interested in learning more about Cuba or somehow being a part of the opposition to the U.S. government's attempt to sink the island, how do you suggest people follow this, and what are you suggesting that people do?
Well, there's a lot of progressive media in the U.S. I think there's a lot of, I mean, I would like to recommend that people on Instagram look up BT Newsroom. That's a breakthrough, which has people on the ground in Cuba reporting, and in Venezuela as well. But it's good, I think, to also read and hear the Cuban voice. And maybe a lot of people don't have Instagram, but the Granma newspaper, the daily newspaper of Cuba, is available in English and Spanish. I'm looking at it right now, and it's G-R-A-N, as in Nancy, M as in mother, A, dot C-U. The reason I recommend it is that ever since the escalation by Trump in August, placing a $50 million bounty on Maduro's head, the bombing of the boats, and including Cuba in the threats by Trump, that we have to look at the voices of Venezuela, the voices of Cuba. And you can read it all in English because they're showing here that there are statements from countries around the world that Cuba is calling for international solidarity to tighten evermore for the victims of U.S. attacks. We have to see what's happening in Cuba and Venezuela in the whole context of Trump. He's like a maniac going through threatening Greenland. We're going to have it. We're going to have Panama. We're going to have, I mean, you name it. And we're going to have Venezuela. They're not going to be able to do what they want to do in Venezuela. Why? Because they couldn't do it with Juan Guaido in 2019 when they imposed this puppet president who never even ran for president. You know, right now they're saying, oh, Maduro, that wasn't a fair election last year. Wait a minute. You placed someone in there, symbolically, Juan Guaido, who never even ran for president. So much for democracy. But the U.S., for all their threats, didn't step a foot in there.
We're going to have to leave it right there. Gloria LaRiva, Richard Becker, Answer Coalition, check them out. They're in the streets, they're engaged, and they're trying to restrain the expanding powers of the current, really neo-fascist president of the United States. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. When we come back, we're going to stay in the region. We're going to talk again about Haiti and Haiti in the context of what's going on now in Venezuela. So stay with us, please. ¶¶
down the days till I'm back with you. Counting down the days. Ooh, I'm missing you. Counting down the days till I'm back with you.
And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. This is your daily investigative news magazine. Again, we apologize for the problems up front. We were cut off the air for some time. Very suspicious about that cutoff, but hopefully it will not happen again. Robert Roth, welcome back to Flashpoints. Haiti in the spotlight in the context of U.S. policy towards Venezuela. And we know that Haitians are deeply hurt. And once again, this kind of policy only reaps more havoc and suffering in Haiti. You want to give us a sense of the situation on the ground there and the way in which it may, what happened in terms of the U.S. expanding hegemony and the attack on Venezuela might impact and even make life in Haiti more miserable. And that's hard to imagine.
Right. That's true, Dennis. I want to start with, you know, the playbook that they used in Venezuela against Maduro and against the government of Venezuela, because for people in Haiti and for Haiti solidarity activists, it's a very, very familiar playbook, because when President Aristide was overwhelmingly elected in 2000 for a second term, the U.S. immediately went to work. They blocked loans. They financed right-wing opposition. They armed and trained paramilitaries to destabilize the country. And they initiated like a massive disinformation campaign, saying without any evidence that Aristide was corrupt, a drug dealer, and a violator of human rights. And of course, this drumbeat was picked up by mainstream media outlets, like the New York Times. Even as Haiti was celebrating the bicentennial of its independence in 2004. And so on February 29, 2004, nearly 22 years ago, U.S. Marines burst into the residence of President Aristide and his wife and colleague, Mildred Truot Aristide, and they kidnapped them at gunpoint and flew them to a military base in the Central African Republic, which was a French neo-colony. Thousands of supporters of Aristide and the Lavalas movement were then killed, imprisoned, or sent into exile. And a series of right-wing governments, reinforced by a U.S.-UN occupation, military occupation, were put into place, creating a situation that Haitians now call a hell on earth for them. And so this playbook, does it sound familiar? It's exactly the playbook that they used in Venezuela. And it's interesting because a lot of the commentary about this, it harkens back to what the U.S. did in Panama, which was in the 1990s, but it's a very recent, a much more recent experience has been the one in Haiti. And, you know, when you ask about the impact of what's going on in Venezuela in relation to Haiti, like, I think that we have to see U.S. strategies both worldwide and in the Caribbean. And so the attack on Venezuela is part and parcel of a number of things that the U.S. has been doing in the Caribbean. And of course, it makes things worse for Haiti because it targets the target of on any progressive government, which Haiti has experienced, and the reinforcing of right-wing regimes in the Caribbean. And the partnering by the U.S. with those regimes is very dangerous to any progressive or radical movement that emerges in the Caribbean and in the Americas. So, for example, the Dominican Republic, which has been notoriously racist towards Haitian migrants who have been there for years, working in the sugar fields, working in factories, over 200,000 Haitians have been deported from the Dominican Republic at the same time as the DR welcomed the U.S., like U.S. strategic forces, into Dominican military bases as they prepared for this attack on Venezuela. Same thing happening in Trinidad and Tobago. Same thing happening in Grenada. There are now 15,000 troops in the Caribbean, mostly in Puerto Rico, you know, which is a U.S. colony, despite all of their fancy talk about a commonwealth and this and that. But U.S. military bases or naval bases, which had been shuttered for years, like because of the resistance of the Puerto Rican people, are now open. And the U.S. military is using Puerto Rico as a staging ground. And in Haiti, they're now talking about sending 5,500 troops, like organized through the UN, to reinforce a new occupation of Haiti. Haiti's been occupied since the overthrow of the Aristide government in 2004. And so there's a plan afoot that in the spring, 5,500 troops will be there, supposedly to prevent, in quotes, gang violence, but mainly to solidify a right-wing government that they will like attempt to install through sham elections, like in a country where most people can't even go out on the street because of the dangers of paramilitary violence associated with the government and with elite business forces. So yes, the situation in Venezuela is a warning to everyone in the Caribbean: either follow our edicts or this will happen to you.
And let's be clear, because there's often confusion. The Haitians are a very poor people, and they are poor, but they're land rich. The resources in Haiti are of great interest to the United States, and in the context of the creation of advanced weaponry and all kinds of other technology of the future. So Haiti has a lot of resources. They just got the people in the way, right?
Well, exactly. Exactly. And also the people are looked at as resources. Obviously, there's mineral wealth in Haiti. The U.S. has been positioned, U.S., Canadian mineral companies positioned to dig up all of the land in Haiti. And that's one of the reasons they need compliant governments to put into place so that basically the land is open for exploitation by U.S. and multinational corporations. And, you know, and that's been the playbook both in Haiti and around, you know, all of the rest of the Caribbean, you know. And so all of these other, you know, things like all the BS about, you know, drug trafficking, and we want democracy, and we want, you know, an end to corruption. The fundamental reason that the U.S. is militarily involved in all of these places is to steal the resources, which they now call ours, and to use the populations for low wage, you know, basically slave labor. And that's the thing about Trump is that Trump is just more open about it. He's much more open, blatant, you know, and this is a fascist administration. And one of the things about fascism, Dennis, as we know, is that it's accompanied by imperialism around the world. It's not just a domestic, you know, state. It is also the enforcement of empire and attacks on populations all around the world. And so in a period like this where we are, we're combating ICE, and we're combating all of these attacks on migrants and people of color in the U.S., we also have to be standing in support of Gaza. We have to follow what's happening in Venezuela and, you know, and really, you know, standing in solidarity with the movement there. And we have to pay attention to all of this, because this is all part and parcel of the same kind of criminal activity that's happening right here in our neighborhoods.
We're speaking with Robert Roth. He's co-founder of Haiti Action, longtime activist in the region. I want to ask you, we were talking about Trump's threats today as of the beginning of next month to shut down all federal aid to sanctuary churches and sanctuary cities. What are the implications for Haitians? Will they suffer as a result of that?
Well, yes, they will. And it's very important. I'm glad you mentioned that, because February 3rd, the U.S. government, Homeland Security, has announced that on February 3rd, all temporary protected status protections for Haitian refugees, many of whom have been here, there's over 300,000 Haitian refugees and migrants living in the U.S., many of whom have been here for decades, that protected status is going to end on February 3rd. It's in the courts, but the Trump administration is absolutely determined to end it and then to begin mass deportations of Haitians. And so one of the things Haiti Action Committee is doing, we're going to organize a demonstration around that time, February 3rd, like to expose this and make it public and say that this is part and parcel of our fight against ICE and all of the criminal activities that they've been involved in. And, you know, there's a racist component, obviously, to yes. anything that the U.S. administration does around Haiti. You know, whether it's J.D. Vance, like, attacking Haitians in Springfield, Ohio, during the election campaign, saying they were eating pets, or Trump calling Haiti, and I can't use the words, over your airwaves, right? Or the fact that they just announced they're ending temporary protected status for Somalis, who are now, the focus of a new series of white supremacist attacks. So yes, this is a very dangerous time, and we're going to be there in solidarity with refugees, not just from Haiti, but from all over the world, who, are sitting right now in the crosshairs of this fascist government.
And what I was sort of caught by this line from copy coming down from Associated Press at one part in describing the situation and the possibilities. They say this cutoff could have far-reaching impacts across the U.S., potentially even in places that aren't particularly friendly to non-citizens. What are more of the multiple implications? Who will be hurt by this? How will folks who aren't necessarily in sanctuary, how could they be hurt?
Well, if you cut off aid, federal aid to sanctuary cities, you're cutting off aid to everyone who lives in those cities. Right now, your target is migrants, obviously. And what you're trying to do is you're trying to threaten any city that defends its migrants. But also, the ending of federal aid will affect every single part of the economy of any of these cities. And obviously, San Francisco is a target. Oakland will be a target, like the entire Bay Area, LA, Minneapolis, all of these places where we see ICE, launching its like horrific raids. Those cities are going to be the target of this new edict. And so, yes, it's something that we all have to unite around. And, I heard Dick Becker and Gloria before, and there's a massive resistance happening in this country. We just have to keep it up in spite of, how horrible it is to wake up every morning, read the news, hear the stories of what's been happening, see the murders that are being committed in our name. We have to keep fighting and we have to keep organizing.
Before we let you go, we have a minute or two. Both of us are teachers. You've been a teacher for a long time, a teacher in the Bay Area. I'm wondering, what do young people think about this? Are they thinking at all about this? Is this sort of going over the heads of young people until it may be too late? Because they're going to be the most impacted if this kind of neo-fascism expands within the country.
Well, you know, as an educator, and I know, Dennis, that you've been an educator for many years as well, both, you know, teaching in New York and also, you know, now on the airwaves, you know, I have tremendous faith in, you know, in young people and in this generation. I think that their consciousness around Palestine has been remarkable. I think that their consciousness and support of migrants is absolutely evident, you know, whether it's in elementary schools where their parents are, you know, doing patrols in front of schools, like to prevent, you know, or to notify anybody that ICE is coming and to stand in resistance to ICE. I think there is a lot of hope for this younger generation that they're being educated about the realities of what this government is up to, you know. So on the one hand, it's a very, very dangerous, awful moment. And on the other hand, we see resistance, and I think that resistance is being and will be led by youth in this next period of time, and I'm very hopeful about it.
Beautiful. Thank you, Robert Roth, Haiti Action co-founder and long time in the streets for the Haitian people. Thank you for the incredibly important and powerful information that you shared tonight and over the years. Thanks for being with us again, Robert Roth.
Appreciate it. Thank you, Dennis. Okay.
You're absolutely welcome, and you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio.
Thank you for listening to Flashpoints. We're going to focus now on the fact that ICE agents shot and killed a woman in Minneapolis, Minnesota. And we are going to start with the mayor of Minneapolis speaking to the public, and then we'll head into the interviews I have, one with a local activist and one with a former FBI agent and whistleblower from the state.
We collectively are going to do everything possible to get to the bottom of this, to get justice, and to make sure that there is an investigation that is conducted in full. But what we do know is that a 37-year-old woman is dead and that she was shot by ICE. We've dreaded this moment since the early stages of this ICE presence in Minneapolis. They are not here to cause safety in this city. What they are doing is not to provide safety in America. What they are doing is causing chaos and distrust. They're ripping families apart. They're sowing chaos on our streets. And in this case, quite literally killing people. So they are already trying to spin this as an action of self-defense. Having seen the video myself, I want to tell everybody directly, that is bull. This was an agent recklessly using power that resulted in somebody dying, getting killed. As soon as it happened and we learned of the incident, we had several priorities. The first, of course, was to get the victim to the hospital and to get care as soon as possible. To the family, I'm so deeply sorry. There's nothing that I can say right now that's going to make you or your relatives or the friends of the victim feel any better. There were, I believe, two Minneapolis police officers that responded and were in the ambulance on the way to the hospital. The second was to get ICE off of the scene. There were dozens, if not hundreds, of ICE and federal officers that were there at the time. Having them there was only causing more chaos. Having them there was only making a difficult situation even more problematic, and one that, yes, they created themselves. There's little I can say, again, that'll make this situation better, but I do have a message for our community, for our city, and I have a message for ICE. To ICE, get the out of Minneapolis. We do not want you here. Your stated reason for being in this city is to create some kind of safety, and you are doing exactly the opposite. People are being hurt. Families are being ripped apart. Long-term Minneapolis residents that have contributed so greatly to our city, to our culture, to our economy are being terrorized, and now somebody is dead.
And now on Flashpoints, we're talking to Tashira Garraway Allen. Welcome to Flashpoints.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Tashira, describe to us what you do and
your connection there in Minneapolis, please.
I work to provide support groups and support to impacted families who have lost loved ones. I did start off helping families that had lost loved ones at the hands of the police. I ended up just helping a numerous amounts of families around the United States, actually, who have lost loved ones, whether that be at the hands of law enforcement, whether that be community violence, just providing, whether that be financial support, whether that be emotional and mental support. My organization that I founded helps families to have that community and have that support after losing a loved one. I also organize many marches and peaceful protests after people are killed in the community, in different marches to speak up for stolen lives.
Thank you for that work. And can you talk to us about what happened today that you know so far in Minneapolis?
Yeah, so there was an observer that was observing ICE agents. We can see from a video that is now going viral that the woman was trying to get away at the time. She was trying to pull away from recording the ICE agents. And at that moment, ICE agents walked up to her vehicle and demanded that she get out of the car. The woman seemed to be afraid and tried to drive away from the situation. And that's when they began to shoot into her vehicle, fire about 4 shots into her vehicle.
And what are you hearing on the street in terms of, you know, eyewitnesses or loved ones, or just what's the general word on the street and feeling?
Well, people are very upset. The people are very traumatized. You know, we had the biggest uprise in the world come out of the city of Minneapolis due to the murder of George Floyd, with all the riots and the protests and everything like that. You know, we had a bunch of federal people come in at that time and kind of incite certain things, riots and things at that time. And then they kind of turn things around and put it back on the protesters, when a lot of times people are peaceful, but yet they are being targeted, and then the narrative kind of gets switched around. So it's a re-traumatizing type situation. It just re-traumatizes us. The feeling that people have right now is literally that Donald Trump put a hit out on Minnesota. This stems back from when George Floyd was killed. And he's been feuding back and forth a little bit with our governor, Tim Walz. Now it just it feels like a tactic being used against our state to put our state under attack.
So you're saying the feeling is that it was a direct hit?
Absolutely. We feel like at the end of the day, and we can't forget who's sending them in to terrorize our community and brutalize our community. We can't forget that, you know. And just being someone that, you know, the father of my son, his name was Justin Tygan, he was found brutally beat to death in a garbage after being pulled over by the St. Paul police in 2009 here in Minnesota. And just going through the trauma of that and watching a video like what we just saw, it's triggering, because it's all happening here in the same state. And so just all of this is really re-traumatizing, and in our whole state, this is a nightmare. This is like a hit out on our state, and it's a complete nightmare. This is happening in residential areas where there's children and elderly people and everything. And it's like the administration doesn't care who they have to hurt in order to push the white supremacy agenda. It's just willing to do whatever it takes. And it's literally at this point deadly and killing people. There was no harm being done to the people that were the ICE agents, that this person, that is not a truthful narrative being spent right now, that she was trying to run them over. you can clearly see in the video, she was literally just trying to get away from the situation. So they actually didn't even have the right to be trying to make her get out of the car. They had no right to even go up to her car because they weren't there for her or her vehicle. They were there to do their ICE raid, and they decided to go after someone who was literally just observing.
We know that people have been tackled and dragged, etc., but do we know that other people, just observers or people trying to protect others who are from being kidnapped by ICE or masked people, have any others been shot that you know of in your area?
No, we haven't had any reports of anybody else being shot by ICE agents. Like you said, we have heard that people have been tear gassed and dragged, you know, on the ground, and even sometimes at a certain point hit by ICE vehicles, dragged by ICE vehicles. But this is the first of our understanding of someone being shot in the city of Minneapolis or in the state of Minnesota.
That's too much. And it can't feel good for anybody who has already lived through what they're living through, and with so many federal police officers, and quite frankly, I mean, we could call them federal agents, but I mean, what does that mean? You know, they swore on something, and maybe, I don't know, did the turkey trot? I don't know. What does it take to become an ICE agent these days, right? So we can call them officers of the law, but that's not what they are. There's no law here except for open season. And that said, I am concerned. I am very concerned. You and I are speaking, you know, prior to most of the protests that will happen in Minneapolis today. I know that you'll probably be live streaming. I know that we would love to check back in with you again. And we want to make sure that, you know, that we're here for you. And this trauma that you're talking about, I hear you and I recognize what you said and the violence that you have experienced personally. It sounds unbearable.
It is unbearable.
And I'm sorry.
Thank you. Thank you for your kind words. Thank you for looking to find out the, you know, truthfulness of what's going on and what's happening and the terrorism that we're facing here in Minnesota. Thank you for your kindness and your heart to even reach out. You know, it's meaningful because it's important to get the true factual information instead of false narratives that's getting spent. Like it the same thing has happened for many of our families who have lost loved ones by federal agents or law enforcement in general. We know how it goes as far as narratives being spent around and being told one thing and then it's actually another thing, you know what I mean? And so I just appreciate you just reaching out and wanting to hear my voice and hear the voice of our families and our community.
Absolutely. And the fact that you still not only move forward, but that you try to help others in their times of grief. And I can sense it in the way that you talk, and when we've been connecting earlier, the fact that you are getting ready to go right in this very unsettling, crazy moment. I do pray for a miracle. I pray for a miracle that all the police, all the so-called officers, all the actual officers all stand down, and that people can protest and speak freely and grieve. And I pray for your safety. And thank you very much for joining us on Flashpoints.
Thank you so much. I appreciate you. Have a good rest of your day.
Thank you. Bye for just now.
Yep. Bye-bye.
Bye. And that was Tashira Garraway Allen, a local advocate and organizer from Minneapolis, Minnesota.
And that wraps it up for another episode of Flashpoints. Our executive producer is Dennis Bernstein.
Senior producers are Miguel Gavilan Molina and Kevin Pina. Technical director is Mike Biggs. For previous episodes, go to kpfa.org or flashpoints.net. For questions or comments, email dennis@kpfa.org. Thank you for listening.